Greetings to all of you accursed. If you already know this pod, you are surely that. Soon to be accursed, if you're a first-time listener, welcome to this special edition live podcast. We're honored to be here at Siege's Anti-Semitism Fight It, Face It conference. I want to thank you for having us be part of this important occasion. I want to give a shout-out to my great friend and brother, Shimon Fogel, who is, I think, a beacon of intellectualism and light and as one of the best people that I've had the fortune to know in my life. So when he asked me to do something, I do it. I'm David Hurley. I want to do a short introduction of the people who put the cuss and discuss in our weekly show. Scott Reed, on my far left, is one of Canada's most sought-after crisis and issues managers. He's been a senior advisor to Prime Minister Paul Martin and counseled CEOs, senior execs, and political leaders at every level. He's seen and heard often on TV and radio, regularly published in places like The Globe. Jordan Leichnitz has over two decades of experience in progressive political strategy and campaigns at every level. She spent 10 years on Parliament Hill in senior strategy positions for the NDP, including Deputy Chief of Staff. Jordan is currently the Canada Program Manager for the Friedrich Ebert Stiff Tongue Foundation. Corey Tenike, on my immediate left. Corey is the guy who makes Doug Ford soft and cuddly, and ultimately very electable. Corey has two decades in public affairs, including Director of Comms for Prime Minister Harper. He was campaign manager for Premier Ford's landslide victory. I don't know why I put landslide in there. The landslide victory in Ontario in 2018. And he was the leading force behind the Premier increasing his majority 4 years later. It's a great panel. I'm thrilled to talk politics with these people every week. Me, David Hurley, I enjoy Lemonheart Rum and the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. I typically pay over $100 for my haircut at a fancy downtown salon. I've worked on campaigns and campaign strategy for the Liberals since the early 80s, people like Ralph Goodale, Paul Martin, and Kathleen Wynne, among many, many others. It's odd for us to be here today because we normally do two things on our podcast, one of which is we have a great time and we laugh and poke fun at the foibles of people that are actually engaged in politics. And the second thing is we take complex issues and boil them down to the crassest, most cynical political considerations. Neither one of those feels really great for today, but we're going to try to put on a show for you. We're going to focus, obviously, on two issues, and one of them is obviously Hamas's attack on Israel and the war on Hamas. We'll talk about that a little bit and what we think some of the domestic political considerations are. And then we'll move on to pure domestic politics. On the heels of David Coletto at Abacus's fresh polling at Abacus Data, we're going to look at where the parties are at right now and what they need to do headed toward an election roughly 2 years or so from now. We've got only 45 minutes. We've got to keep this tight. So let's get going. Corey, just thought maybe we would start by going around and giving each of us an opportunity to just talk a little bit, because we haven't actually had this conversation, actually talk a little bit about how we've been feeling over the course of the past week, how we feel about what happened in Israel a week ago, and what we think, maybe what some of our thoughts are going forward in Canada about this subject. You start us off?
Sure. Well, I don't think I'm alone in this room or any room in Canada right now. And seeing the images coming out of Israel after the attack are, you know, devastating. They're emotionally jarring. They're upsetting, I think, for anyone. It's just such a horrific scene to see. And I don't know, it makes me think of, you know, great moments that the world has been challenged with in the past, you know, and I think you can't see those images and not think of the Holocaust, not think of World War II, not think of other times in our history where we've been confronted with challenging situations and great evil. And I'm not a foreign policy expert or a military expert, but you know, my view of history is such that with some people you can have no peace. And my view is as difficult as responding to this challenge is, that at least to my eyes and my mind, I see no path to a sustainable peace for Israel in which Hamas retains power in Gaza. And I think the difficulty of the operation ahead will challenge everyone. But in the same way that, you know, the great tragedies that were associated with removing the Nazis from power in World War II, you know, whether it's civilian losses or disruption in every way imaginable and horrific stories coming out of that, there is no alternative to that final outcome in terms of the removal of this terrorist organization from control of Gaza. And I think we just must steel ourselves for that.
Right.
Thanks, Corey. Jordan, I would look to you next. And in your remarks, could you just touch a little bit on, I'm just going to say this. I mean, I know that all of the leaders in Canada's support for Israel comes from a deeply principled position. But I think it is particularly difficult for the NDP leadership because their base, some of their party membership, is not as supportive. And so the kind of strong support you get from NDP leadership on this, and are getting from Jagmeet Singh on this issue, I think is an illustration of the principle from which he approaches the question.
Yeah, thanks for that question, David. And I think, you know, to say right off the top, it's been an incredibly difficult and emotional week, I think, for a lot of progressives who follow what happens in the region. And, you know, we're now with news today of a sixth Israeli-Canadian dead, two missing. This is horrific, and you know, these are Canadians also, right? You know, the conversations that happen within the left and within the NDP on this topic can be very difficult, and they can be very heartfelt. There are people who have spent their lives working in solidarity with Palestinians and who see the conflict through that long lens. And of course, we also have to acknowledge that you can support the Palestinian cause without excusing Hamas's terror, and that, in fact, that must be the bar of entry to the conversation. And I think the challenge that Jagmeet and the NDP leadership have is threading that needle in a way that honors New Democrat and progressive values. And that means being clear about the absolute horrendous nature of Hamas's attacks and that there can be no excuse for terror, but also upholding international law in the Israeli response in Gaza. And so I think you're going to see him trying to do that in a way that sticks really close to the human realities of both Palestinians and Israelis who are caught up in this. And I have to say, on a personal level, you know, it's very dark. It's dark right now. And it's been difficult to see progressives and the left not everybody cleared that bar about Hamas. And that's bad. And that's a problem. But I do find hope. You know, I think there's such a rich tradition within Israel of progressive politics, of leftist politics, of people who work for peace, reaching out to Palestinians who share that goal of peace, even through these darkest moments. And, you know, maybe I'll leave you on this with a text message that really struck me this week. Was a Palestinian in Gaza who was engaged in some peace dialogues with a colleague in Israel and was talking about the bombing and just what was happening. And at the end he said, "I hug you deep inside my heart." You know, there are people, even in the darkest hour, still reaching out for that better future. And I think that matters a lot.
Mm. Thank you, Jordan. Scott, you've got a long time of familiarity with this issue. You worked for Prime Minister Martin when he started to change Canada's votes at the UN on matters regarding Israel. What were your thoughts over the course of the past week?
Well, first, I just want to say that I think for us, this is a real privilege to be here at this time. Like, this is an extraordinary, extraordinary time to be here. And, you know, all we can say with any hope of being correct is that we're going to see some profound changes over the course of the next few weeks. And the implications politically, geopolitically, on a personal level for so many people. I think of a couple of things. I want to pick up on the point that you made about, you know, the consensus that you can see with the political leadership in the country, not just mouthing the words that Israel has a right to defend itself, but condemning in no uncertain terms Hamas as terrorists, condemning their actions. Think about this room. On the way in, Corey and I encountered David Cooper, and made me think about 7-8 years ago when I went with a whole large delegation of folks from all the political parties. We had a new Democrat, we had a new bloc member on that trip. I was there with Melissa Lansman, now the deputy leader of the Conservatives, was on that same trip. And I just think, you know, this consensus that you see at the highest levels politically doesn't happen by accident. And, those trips, the hard work of everyone in this room and the organization, I mean, it pays off. It is sometimes in defiance of political opportunism, that consensus. I just think that's as somebody who thinks about putting together political coalitions and establishing political consensus, to have affected that kind of consensus, it's an extraordinary thing, and it shouldn't be overlooked, the work that's been done by Sija and others. And the obvious thing that I would say as a last note is that I'm anxious about it. I mean, you know, but the focus on anti-Semitism, we know what's to come. We know that the response that Israel must make is and will continue to test that consensus, that there are dark, dark days ahead. And, I think we got to maintain that pressure on political leaders to maintain that consensus and not see it erode.
Yeah. Well, let's just pick up on that a little bit. Stick with you, Scott, for a second, pick up on that a little bit, because we know that public opinion will shift
Yep.
through the offensive in Gaza. And I was watching the CBC News last night, and this is, you should get myself in trouble, I'm a fan of the CBC, but not in this particular instance. I watched the CBC News last night, and there a lot of coverage of what's going on in Gaza. There was no story about Israel anymore. Like, the attacks in Israel seem to be in the past, gone, forgotten. The context for what's going on seemed to be gone and forgotten. Do you have any thoughts on how you move forward in an environment like that?
Well, it's going to be challenging because, the media spotlight follows where the ball bounces, and the ball is going to bounce in Gaza. It's not going to bounce in Israel. And,
it's called news for a reason.
Yeah, and that's, it's going to be very troubling. I just personally, I have 4 sons. The 2 older boys are, and you know them well, 25 and 20. I kept thinking about that music festival. So as it fades from, that was 5 days ago. Editorially, we can't defend, keep talking about that. We have to talk about what's happening today, what will happen tomorrow. I think it's going to be more challenging. This is the sort of thing that I mean. Like, the consensus is going to be tested. And, I think Jewish voices, not just Jewish and Israeli voices, but a whole suite of voices, talking about the hardships that are being endured. The stories of all the families that are affected. I don't know about you guys, but I have people in my life who have family members got on a plane and went to Israel. So I think maintaining those stories is going to be vital, because it won't occur naturally, is my concern. The maintenance of the consensus won't occur naturally. It's going to have to be forced. It's going to have to be cultivated. It's going to have to be really nurtured.
Corey, good.
Well, I think that there are going to be a lot of other news events that occur as this crisis progresses, as this war progresses. I think the tragic story of the hostages is going to continue to play out, and I fear in graphic and horrible ways. We've lived through versions of that in the past with ISIS, and the degree of barbarism that can be demonstrated in those situations can be jarring, and I think that will continue to come to the fore. I think if we see Iran and Hezbollah, you know, act and open another front in a wider and more fulsome way, that's going to drive a lot of news too. And I think, you know, while I don't want either of those two things to happen, and none of us here today know what's going to happen, I think there is a high probability that both of those things are going to happen. And I think a natural conclusion coming from that for a lot of Canadians and a lot of people around the world is going to be that this is a war for fundamentally the existence of the state of Israel. And that we have to decide whether the world wants to compromise on something like that. And I think for the vast, vast, vast overwhelming number of Canadians, there's a very clear answer, and that is that yes, not only should it must, and that we have to continue this fight until we reach a place where there can be peace. And it might take a while, but I think it's going to keep coming up.
But the difficulty, if I could put it to any three of you, the difficulty is that it is literally impossible for a Canadian who hasn't been to Israel to really understand the vulnerability of that position that they're in, and to really understand the security issues around that. And yes, Canadians support the existence of the State of Israel, and they support it because it's a democracy and because it's an ally. But for all those same reasons, there is a double standard applied here. They do have higher expectations of Israel.
Well, it's a matching of those expectations with the rest of the world. Like, not only is Israel a democracy, but it's one that, while there's criticism, as there is in Canada, around, you know, many issues, I look at issues related to...
You're no fan of judicial activism either, are you?
Right.
Entirely depends on the activism.
I'm thinking more around First Nations. I'm thinking there are many reasons why you can be critical of any country and any democracy, and the health and strength of democracies is that we allow those discussions to happen. But I challenge where else in the region can you have that discussion, where you can have that debate, where minority rights are protected? You know, there used to be a Jewish quarter in every city in the region, and those don't exist, but there is still an Arab quarter in Jerusalem. And you know, you can still hear the call to prayer in Jerusalem. Like, to draw a false moral equivalence between what Israel is facing and how Israel treats its own citizens and minorities within its community, there is no equivalence. Like, it is just not at all the same.
So I think you pose a really important question, though, in terms of what can be done here from Canada in order to keep that consensus, you know, around the political response. And to me, you know, like a good New Democrat, I'm going to give you a policy answer to a political question, as we like to do. And I think one of the things that's really important to consider is that in this difficult circumstance, what is Canada's value added on the international stage? What is it that we bring to the table? And you've already seen the government do a little bit of that. So Canadian involvement in negotiating for the hostages' release, this is really, you know, that's a positive place where we have things to contribute. But Canada also has quite a lot to contribute in dealing with the urgent humanitarian situation in Gaza. And if we want to hold together a political consensus around support for Israel, there is a reality that dealing with that emerging catastrophe needs to happen. And this is where Canada, I think, can really actually chip in. And so that's everything from actual aid. There's been donations, but of course that aid's got to be able to get into Gaza. So can you negotiate a humanitarian corridor? Can you join in negotiating a humanitarian ceasefire to get that aid in and to get your nationals out? What can you do there to help alleviate the terrible human cost that's occurring there? And I think, you know, if you look out over the medium term, there's a big role for Canada. And there's a big role actually for Canada in Gaza, potentially. Who is going to run Gaza when Hamas is gone? Is it the UN? Can the Canadians be helpful in that? what's going to happen to people who are internally displaced or refugees if they leave. We have expertise there. So there's all sorts of things, everything down to rebuilding. And these are things actually that are really, I think, helpful in terms of making sure that Canadians see the full impact of the military operations there being addressed by the Canadian government as well. And I think that actually shores up support for a broader support for Israel in the area.
All right, let's move on. Talk a little domestic politics. So this past week, Abacus Data had a poll. Overall in the poll, they said that Conservatives were 39%, headed toward a large majority. The Liberals are at 26%. The NDP are at 18%. What really caught our eye in this poll, though, I have to take out my reading glasses for this.
You should note, David, that according to David Coletto's tracking, that means the Liberals have come up too, right? Or no, the Conservatives have dropped two.
Conservatives have dropped two, yeah, exactly.
So the government's rallying.
Government's in great shape. Here's what really caught our eye. Abacus Data asked Canadians who would be better at dealing with the various issues, Trudeau or Poilievre. Taking action to deal with climate change, 37% say Trudeau, 30% say Poilievre. Making childcare more affordable, 36% say Trudeau, 32% say Poilievre. Protecting and improving the public health care system, 31% say Trudeau, 38% say Poilievre. Dealing with Donald Trump if he becomes president of the United States again, 28% say Trudeau, 37% say Poilievre. Managing the economy and creating good-paying jobs, 28% Trudeau, 43% Poilievre. Building more housing and making it more affordable, 28% Trudeau, 40% Poilievre. Making life more affordable for you, 27% Trudeau, 44% Poilievre. Keeping taxes as low as possible, 22% Trudeau, 46% Poilievre. So, Scott Reed, this is a government that has focused so much of its energy around climate, and they've got a 7-point advantage over Poilievre. Yeah. They actually brought in a national child care program of $10 a day. They've got a 4% lead over Poilievre. They've just devoted billions and billions of dollars to the health care system. They're 7 points behind Poilievre. And then on anything to do with the economy, they're not even in the ballpark with Poilievre. And interestingly, despite the fact that Trudeau dealt with the Trump administration, got NAFTA passed, he's still seen as not as good to deal with even Trump as Poilievre. So, other than the fact that any realistic assessment of this data set would tell you that Trudeau shouldn't run again, what else does it tell you?
Is there a second thing? I say that because I'm not convinced that Trudeau now. I'm not convinced that Trudeau leaving is actually going to help the Liberals. I think it probably has a fair shot of harming them even further. You know, I think when you get an across-the-board set of results like that, it's really one result. It means that people want change. It means that you could run to the liquor store, show up breathlessly on someone's porch and say, here, I bought you all these drinks. And people would say, I didn't want to drink now, I want to drink later. Like, there's just it's a surrogate for leadership, it's a surrogate for satisfaction, that issue battery. And, you know, to my mind, if you're the government, you know, the first step is, if what you're doing isn't working, then stop doing those things and do something else. And I, you know, we've talked about this hundreds of times, David and I, and we've talked about it dozens of times on the podcast collectively. I think the number one thing that alarms me as a Liberal when I hear all those numbers is there's clearly no economic message coming from the government. So there's zero sense of an economic message. And I think the government is going to have to stop doing as many things as it does, do fewer things, and do them more loudly, more brazenly, and more boldly, and try to punch through. And I think that's got to start with the economy. If people don't have a sense that they're going to be there on economic matters. I don't think they're going to care much else. You got to turn one of these issues not into a surrogate for leadership, but rather an issue about which you can have a fight. And you know, I think you really got to. Now is if I'm a football fan, if the government was a quarterback who'd been brought in the fourth quarter, you'd say, all right, we're down. The first thing we're going to do is shorten the playbook. Right now, the playbook is too long, too complicated, and they've got to shorten the playbook. So I think that means starting with the economy. I am also starting, I'll just throw this thought out, maybe it'll set you guys buzzing. I am starting to wonder whether it needs to bail on some big policies and whether whether the results are so profoundly negative on what it is doing, whether it needs to say, all right, we're doing some other things. I mean, this cabinet shuffle in the summer was supposed to be a reset. It's not a reset. You can't do the same goddamn things over and over and over and expect people to say, I've come to the conclusion you're doing something else better and that I like more. And I'm warning them that they're going to have to off-ramp on stuff. And we're probably going to talk about the Supreme Court ruling and that stuff at some point. And I'm wondering if maybe that offers, in a weird way, an opportunity for the government to say, let's beat a strategic retreat in a couple places, or at least present ourselves as doing so. And why? In order to get the balance right so that we can do more on economic matters.
Hey, Jordan. One of the things that's in this data is the Liberals are closer to the NDP in public support than they are to the Conservatives.
Yeah, well, I always say the New Democrats love that, because if you get that flipped.
I always believed the Liberals couldn't go into the 20s.
Yeah.
Like, whenever I was involved, I always believed the Liberals cannot go into the 20s. You cannot hold the center of the political environment if you're that low in public support. The Liberal Party has to be in the 30s at least. And so does this present opportunity for the NDP?
I think it does. I think it's opportunity laced with challenge, though. So there's no real clean opportunity for the NDP, but there's some potential there for them. And what I mean by that is I largely agree with what Scott has said in terms of the analysis. What this just tells us is that Canadians are done. They are done with Trudeau. They are ready for a change, and it's really hard to come back from that. And if you look at the issue sets where Trudeau has taken such a hit, some of these are things that they have tried to exert some energy on over the last 6 months. Like those housing numbers, a 17-point spread is brutal when you look at the amount of funding and energy that they're trying to devote to that as a story. So they have really failed to connect with Canadians in terms of a story about what their government is about. Why are they there? What is Trudeau actually doing? And what's his purpose now, especially if he's seeking another term? For the NDP, obviously, everything axes on the confidence and supply agreement. So the agreement, I think, has had utility for them so far. It's allowing them a lot of control. They can squeeze the government for policy concessions that they otherwise wouldn't have had. It's put Singh, who is the leader of the fourth party, really in the driver's seat of a lot of decision-making that he wouldn't otherwise have access to. But they're coming to a place where all the easy stuff has been done. So you're left with things in that agreement that are much harder, things like pharmacare, where we know the Liberals don't really want to move ahead on it. And so they're at a bit of a crossroads, and you saw this at the convention over the weekend in terms of the discussion and debate about whether the party should pull support for the confidence and supply agreement if they don't get pharmacare. To me, that's less about the actual policy issue and more a proxy for how people are thinking about the utility of that agreement within the party. And so I think that you have probably two paths ahead of you for New Democrats. If the Liberals want more time, and Lord knows they need more time with these numbers, then I think you will likely see some openness to renegotiating on one or two priorities that makes political sense for both the Liberals and the New Democrats, that connects more readily with what people are experiencing in the affordability and the housing crisis. Or I think you're going to see Singh teeing up to pull support in the spring. I think that if it gets to a point where it's clear that there's no more concessions forthcoming from the Liberals, he really doesn't have much choice but to walk back from it or appear completely powerless. Now, does that mean the government falls instantly? Because I can hear Scott crying for mercy over here. No, it doesn't, because always there's the possibility for the NDP to support on a vote-by-vote basis. And of course, there's other dance partners within Parliament as well for the Liberals. They could look to the Bloc for certain things. And they could, you know, they can muddle along for a few more months. So the real question is, are the Liberals, how badly do they want that certainty to get to 2025? And what are they going to do with that time if they manage to buy it?
2025, you know, Corey, I ran into Pierre Poilievre in the airport. And I told him I didn't think the election was going to be till 2026.
Because 2025 is when Trudeau will quit, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because Trudeau, I think there's only, I think there's at best a 50% chance that Trudeau runs again. At best a 50% chance that Trudeau runs again. But he will, like, if history is any guide, whether you look at Mulroney or his or Trudeau's father, that they actually go to the fifth year. Like, it takes the actual imminence of we're out of time legally for them to say, okay, I got to go now. I mean, nobody likes to leave this job, right?
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's true. And there are obvious solutions to the problems that ail them, I think. It's just ones that I don't think Trudeau can do. Like, if you look at those numbers that you shared with us, I take two things away from that, David. I take that there is a crisis of confidence in terms of the competency of the government. And when I look at a Liberal scoring higher than a Conservative on healthcare, that's about competence. When I see the numbers around foreign affairs, and we've discussed this before, the last thing you lose generally as a prime minister is who's best to represent the country on the world stage. That is the last thing to go. Like, even when Brian
Mulroney... The day we lost the election in 2006, Paul Martin was winning that metric.
Well, even at 9% in the darkest days of the Mulroney era, he still had a double-digit lead in that area. So, like, it's the last thing to go. So I view that as a crisis of competence, and you can look at a bunch of different things, whether it's questions around our relationship with India, whether it's foreign interference, whether it's getting a passport on time. These things all speak to the competence of the government, and I think what those numbers reflect is that the public doesn't have faith that this is a government that can competently execute on anything. And I think the second crisis that they're having is confidence in their priorities. If you think of the ballot question that Trudeau was elected on, it was centered around priorities for the middle class and trying to elevate the middle class in terms of their income and the quality of life and standard of living that they had within the country. You know, those who are in the middle class and those who are working hard to join it, right? Like, that was the slogan in which they got elected. When you look at housing, when you look at the economy, all of those questions, they have lost the middle on those questions. They have lost the faith that the government is focused on things that are going to help people pay their mortgage, which, you know, a ton of Canadians are worried about right now, about the integrity of their paycheck, that, you know, they're not, you know, we have high inflation and their paycheck is not increasing at the same speed as inflation. They're losing purchasing power with every passing month. So, you know, those things, I think, are about priorities. Now, what's the most obvious thing that the government could do with a stroke of a pen passage of an act of parliament, but a version thereof? It's to roll back the carbon tax, which is entirely at the discretion of the government. If you're looking at the issue set that is helping to propel Poilievre to where he is in the polls right now, I would say that is a foundational piece of that. It's not only speaks to those causes, but it's a very particular thing that you could do. And when that was brought in, I think the public was more of the mind that it was, if you didn't do a carbon tax, you didn't care about climate change. Well, that was a different world. Now we've seen a lot of other countries, including the one that matters the most to Canada, the United States, pursue a credible course of action on reducing carbon emissions, dealing with climate change, that does not involve a carbon tax. And guess which one of those two countries is going to hit their carbon reduction targets? It's not Canada. And that sort of opens people's minds, or a much larger number of people's minds, to the fact that you can actually get rid of a carbon tax and pursue a different policy path, deal with climate change, and also improve people's standard of living. And I don't think that, and I think we probably all agree, I don't think Trudeau can go there. He's so married to that policy, it's almost central to his core identity. So that leads
me to... He would just look cynical. People wouldn't...
No, I don't think people would believe it. They think it'd come back. It's too little, too late. It would be... it would make the people who are with him on that, you know, lose faith in him. So I think that leads me to a leadership change is the only option there that gives them any path to re-election that's obvious from where we sit today.
Jordan, let me put something else on the table, which is I agree with Corey 100% about the carbon tax. You know, I've always thought it was a political loser, and part of the Liberals' decline this spring and summer is surely when that tax came into effect in Atlantic Canada and the bottom fell out of Liberal support in Atlantic Canada. But if you actually look at the polling data on a map, tracking over time, it's really interest rates that have caused the close race becoming a wide gap. It's really interest rates. So should the government issue a special directive to the Bank of Canada?
Oh my God, yes. I think they should. Not a directive, but I do think...
It would say, make the economy better.
Yeah, fix it.
It would say, lower rates and richer people, please.
Yeah. No, a directive is probably not on the menu, and I can hear all my economist friends crying in the background. But I do think that there is a political question around central bank policy that's a conversation worth having in Canada right now. And this is a conversation that you saw the premiers get in on. David Eby started this. You've seen labor leaders get in on it. And really what the message is that if we have a monetary policy that relies on driving our economy into a recession to prove central bank credibility, something is broken there. And I think that that's a very reasonable conversation to have. And unfortunately, unfortunately for the Liberals, I don't think that they are going to be institutionally capable of having it. That's a difficult thing for a sitting prime minister to take on, given concerns about central bank independence. But I think that that's where more and more people are, that the system doesn't really make sense as it is, and that the financial pain and hardship that they're experiencing in their lives is not at all being reflected by the government. And they need to find a way to quickly reflect that feeling. And that's really what's been missing for them.
Just quickly on this, before Scott jumps in, this might be a weird confluence, but you know, it's not just EB, it's Premier Ford as well talking about this. But I think there is a serious debate that needs to occur with economists. Runaway inflation, not good for your economy, that's obviously bad. But I think there is a question about a target of 2%, which should be had. You know, if you are dealing with higher food prices due to a war in Ukraine that's driving those prices up, if you're seeing a onshoring of manufacturing, which is going to cause inflationary pressure as well, if you're seeing, you know, disruptions in around China and Taiwan and global supply chains, no amount of raising interest rates in Canada is going to push you below whatever that baseline inflation created by those things are. And is there something magical about 2% that was set, you know, 30 years ago? Like, you know, show your math. You know, and I think there is, if the Bank of Canada wants to retain the confidence of people running the country and people living in the country, they need to, you know, show their math on that. You know, we need to have a conversation about it. It's happening anyway. And if you're talking about directives that the government could give around that issue, I think it would be that, to say, look, you know, let's have a conversation about what the target rate should, you know, should be. And that should be something that I think should change a bit based on the larger global environment. And I think there's, you know, a very good economics conversation that should be had around that.
Scott, there's a great irony here, right? Because, of course, a couple of years ago, the Liberals were having great fun at the expense of Poilievre for having suggested that he would fire the governor of the Bank of Canada for having allowed inflation to get out of control, and the notion that you would in any way interfere with the sanctity of the Bank of Canada and its independence was a proof that Poilievre was an irrational person who was not suited to be the Prime Minister. But surely to Christ, they're tempted to call Tiff Macklem right now and say, you're just killing us, man.
Well, I mean, look, whether it's the carbon tax, whether it's directive to the, you know, to the Bank of Canada, I think, go back to Coletto's polling. Go back to the fact that you're losing on every issue, even issues that are traditionally yours, not only as a government, but traditionally yours for decades as a political party.
Healthcare.
Right? Healthcare. For love of Christ, how can you be losing on healthcare if you're a Liberal government, right? And so, again, I'm just going to apologize to folks not familiar with the podcast, but we swear on this podcast. And so I think we're into WTFN territory here. Why the fuck not? Like, if someone says to me, what about the carbon tax? You put all these handcuffs on yourself and you're in government. Well, we can't even have an argument about that internally, whether or not we would do the carbon tax, because it would be seen as so cynical. It would be such a fundamental reversal of policy. It would erode our identity even further. Okay, maybe, maybe not. We can't possibly make a directive to the Bank of Canada because that's absolutely ultra vires. No, 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 we can't do that. Oh, okay, maybe, maybe not. There's going to be seven other agreements that if you open up a case of beer, you can come up with. They need to open up that case of beer, lock themselves in a room, and write every single crazy, spasmodic, reach for the bleachers idea, and then have an argument with all of them, and then pick one. Right. Because I am sure of this. If they keep doing in an incremental fashion what they are doing now, maybe a little bit better, or perhaps just a little bit less atrociously unwell, they are not going to win the next election. They may not even alter these numbers in any fundamental way. So it's either something different, or it's your Waterloo.
Right. All right. I think it's time for the Hey Yous.
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
All right. Jordan, give us a Hey You.
Well, I guess my Hey You is for someone who didn't take Scott's advice. So this goes out to Minister Champagne, who in the great fight for more reasonable food prices for Canadians today managed to generate the headline.
I will bring in the CEOs. I will
just
tell them to
I'm just going to read it because it's
make
pretty
them
good.
Small.
He wishes grocers were more forthcoming on price stabilization. And so to that I say, hey you, if only someone were in charge. If only somebody had the responsibility of bringing people together and perhaps instead of just asking politely for keeping prices the same, not even lowering them, you could set yourself up for some success by actually having some teeth in your interactions with the grocers. But he did not do that, and so he gets to enjoy headlines like this. So that's my hey you this week.
There you go. Well, I got a. We have a great little group chat where we go over politics and stuff before. And I got to say, I found the best gift ever for Champagne. It's Napoleon riding a Shetland pony. It's fantastic. my hey you. Speaking of Champagne, is for MPs from any party. You know, we've seen stories like this. There's one in the media today. If you're going out on a junket or going out being entertained by somebody else, and you know there's 100% chance that, you know, these expenses are going to be publicly reported, you might want to skip from the $600 bottles to something like a little bit more.
How's this Cristel going to look in the Globe?
Prosecco is really good. Let me recommend that.
You know, it's one of these things where you give up certain things to run for office and be in public life. And, you know, of course, you can spend as much on champagne as you want on your own dime. But if you're going to do it in a way that's publicly reported, you're probably not, and especially in this cost of living, you know, environment, going to engender a lot of goodwill with voters if you're engaging in that sort of thing. So, hey, you MPs, watch the expenses, especially at this time, because Canadians don't want to see that kind of shit.
You know who has a really keen eye for that stuff is Jenny Byrne from Fenland Falls.
Now you're going to get me in a lot of trouble.
My hey you, sort of turning to what is on everyone's mind here, I guess, is Melanie Joly. I think, you know, give the give the foreign affairs minister real high marks, got to the region, visiting all the posts, visiting all the missions. I don't know how loud our voice is. I don't know how powerful our muscles are there, but at least she was there, being seen, pushing forward, making the arguments that need to be made. And I just think, you know, that's what you need to ask of a minister of foreign affairs in the middle of an international crisis. Be present, be on the ground, be listening to your missions, and be listening to the people that are affected and saying, what can we do to help? And I thought that was, as far as I could tell, what she was doing, and that's what she ought to be doing. So top marks.
You're here. Yes.
My Hey You goes out to a man I've had the privilege to know for many years and learn from and be inspired by. And one of the things I love most about the Martin government was that he was the justice minister in it. He's just relinquished his post as the government's chief advisor on anti-Semitism. But My Hey You goes out to Erwin Kotler for a lifetime public service and inspiration. And I just want to conclude by saying to you that I've been to Israel 5 times. It's a beautiful country. I love it. We all love it. And we all stand with you in support of it.